He was in his early 30s, and he wanted to please God 100%. And so there was a special sensitivity when the Spirit of God tugged on his heart, and he followed that tug, left where he lived, the community with which he was familiar, and went out of town to a remote place, really, a place where no one else lived. I suppose you would say it was like a camping trip, except on the spur of the moment, he had taken no gear, nor had he taken food or water. I suppose that he should have thought of the risks, but risk was not for a moment on his mind. All he thought about was that this was the great opportunity to experience God. I don't know if you've ever tried that. I have. Oh, not for 6 weeks the way he did, but for a week once, just to get away, to escape the pressures, the ordinary routine of life, to have a different agenda, a different schedule, and expect to meet God there. Although he tried something that I have tried, but not to the extent that he did, and that is fasting, not eating. I found that you get a headache when you do that, but I've tried it for a day or a couple of days, but not for an extended period of time. They say, those that do it for a long time, that it increases your sensitivity, that it has an enormous impact in the way you see everything and perceive and relate, and that fasting especially increases your sensitivity to God so that you communicate with him in an experience that you've never had before. After a month and 10 days, it turned out quite different than what he had anticipated. For at the end of that time, I'm not sure you could quite say that he had so wonderfully experienced God and all that he had hoped. Most of all, he was hungry. And he met the devil, not God. Yeah, he did. He really did. He actually met the devil face to face. And he was very vulnerable. The devil, sensing his hunger, said to him, "Look, why don't you have some fresh, hot loaves of bread? Just speak the word, and they're yours." And when you're hungry enough, it's amazing what you'll do. But he decided that he would rather go hungry than eat a single crumb off the devil's platter. And so Satan quickly changed his strategy and took him to a scenic overlook high above the city where he could see down below all of the people that he had been so lonely for so long. And the devil said to him, "Jump." Not suggesting suicide, but with supernatural information telling him that if he were to jump, that angels would somehow fluff the way and take him gently to the ground, and he who had been alone for so long could at last see people, and he who had wanted more than anything else to experience God could have a miracle. Who doesn't want a miracle? It was, in a sense, the opportunity of a lifetime. While he thought about it long and hard, he declined again. He concluded that the last thing he should do is jump when the devil tells him to jump. And having refused, the devil tried a third tactic. This time, taking him high on a mountain on a clear day when it seemed as if you could see forever, so that he could see the geographical lay of the land. He could look in every direction and see the borders of the political kingdoms. And Satan said, "I'll offer you a deal that any good man would seriously think about taking. I am willing to step down from my position as the evil ruler of the world. I will quit all of the things that I've always done. I will stop clouding people's vision so that they cannot see God. I will cease all of my approaches that intervene in people's lives to make happy people miserable. I'll turn it all over to you. You can rule the world, and I'll leave you alone. I'll back off. Now, any good man would think about seizing that opportunity. If for nothing else, to get the devil and his evil ways aside, but to instead rule the world with good. But he decided that there must be a hook in there somewhere. There's something about this that doesn't ring true. There's got to be a ploy behind it that will turn what seems to be good into evil. And so he refused a third time. I would have anticipated a fourth and a tenth and a 35th strategy to follow. But a most surprising thing happened. For it seems that the devil thought baseball, and with three strikes, he decided that he was out. And so he was out. He just left. And the winner of that true story was Jesus. Jesus, who was greatly tempted, enormously pressured by a slick, evil enemy who wanted to destroy Jesus forever. Now, that's the good news, but the frightening news is that when the devil failed in his strategy of getting to Jesus, he decided that he would instead select more vulnerable targets. Us. And what are our chances? What are our chances against such a great and smart and powerful enemy? Well, there's another surprise. For the truth of it is that our chances are very good, according to James 4:7, that what worked for Jesus will work for us. That if we resist the devil, he will flee from us. The first step in actually implementing that is to identify who is this great enemy that we're talking about. The Bible says that your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Do you know that the surveys show that 55% of Americans believe that the devil is real? Which is to say, of course, that 45% of us don't think that. Which seems to be a successful strategy right off the top. For if you have an enemy that is convinced that you are not an enemy at all, then you have already gone a long way toward winning the battle. The Bible's teaching about the devil is really quite clear. Number one, that Satan is real. That he is not a figment of our imagination or a literary illusion or some symbol of evil. But rather, that the devil is as real as God or as you or I. And that he is a person. He is a person who has bright intellect and strong emotions and a clearly directed will. That he thinks and acts and has a personality, just as we have personalities. And the Bible says that Satan is evil. Not a mixture of good and evil, not some good with the bad, but 100% bad. That even though he may sometimes look good and seem to have a strategy for good, it is really a strategy for wickedness. That he is the most evil person of any time and any place and anywhere. That while there is evil far more broadly spread, that it is in him that the greatest concentration of all exists. And the Bible teaches that Satan is supernatural. That the devil has an intelligence that is greater than the brightest genius we could ever meet. And that he has a power that far exceeds anything that we would consider to be human. That he is fully capable of outsmarting us and outthinking us on any topic and overpowering us in any way. That we humans, because he is supernatural, are absolutely no match for him. And so it is a frightening thing to imagine ever trying to compete with so strong an enemy. But the Bible also explains that Satan is not God. And unfortunately, too many people have mistakenly thought that because of his reality, because of his personality, because of his evil and his power, that Satan is somehow an evil equivalent to God. that God is the good one and Satan is the bad one. They think that Satan knows everything there is to know, including the thoughts that we think. But that's not true. He doesn't know everything. For only God is omniscient. Or there are some people who think that Satan has all power, that he can do whatever he chooses and he cannot be stopped. But that is not true. For only God is omnipotent. And there are those who think that Satan can be everywhere at the same time. That he can be in India as well as in Indianapolis at the exact same moment. Or that he can be in Indianapolis and Minneapolis on the same day, at the same hour. But he can't. Because only God is omnipresent. Sometimes I hear people say that Satan met me yesterday and he pressured me, he tempted me, he forced me, he tripped me. But there's the chance of a mistake there. For it assumes that out of 5.5 billion people in all of the world, that that person has been selected as the single target for Satan's attention that day and that moment, to the neglect of 5.5 billion almost other people. Maybe we could understand if we compared to someone nowhere near as evil, but sort of a personification of evil in our minds as we think of history, and that is a half century ago, Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler, who was truly a man of evil power and great influence, who controlled the minds and the destinies of millions of people. But we know that he couldn't be everywhere at the same time, nor did he know everything that was going on. But rather, he created a system with a structure and had his representatives so that he had others who agreed to obey him and to implement his will. I have walked the sites of the concentration camps at Dachau in Germany, and Auschwitz in Poland. I don't know, at least, that Hitler was ever there. I don't ever remember in their museum seeing a photograph of him at those places. I don't ever remember in any reading or movies that I've seen any record of Hitler ever visiting those places of infamy. But he still was able to implement his terrible strategy and inflict his horrors on millions of victims. And so we need to understand that Satan, much the same way, can only be in one place at one time and has limited power and limited knowledge, but he works through other means, through those who are in his employ, those who are his representatives. And we need to be careful in our identification of the enemy not to underestimate him, but at the same time never to overestimate him either. He is not God, nor is he God's equal. He can be resisted, and he can be chased away. The Greek name for Satan is diablos, which means to slander, to accuse, to malign. And so it is the strategy of this great enemy of ours to find cause in our lives to malign us, to slander us, to accuse us before God. He has many strategies with which he works, but none that he uses more than dealing with human pride. Pride is an exaggerated view of ourselves. It is thinking that we are better, that we are more important than we really are. Pride is believing, as Adam and Eve came to believe, that we are at least as good as God. Maybe in understanding our situations that we are, in fact, even a little bit better than God. Pride, as it grows in its development, becomes the conviction that we can successfully live without including God or his ways in our lives. And so, as we understand the strategy of Satan in using pride, we begin to connect that to our own lives and experiences. And we see that high on his list of specific tactics are to deal with us especially in terms of wounded pride. My pride is wounded when I'm put down. Our pride is wounded when we don't get our own way, when we don't look as good as we think we should look in front of other people. Wounded pride is a strong, strong commodity in human relationships. Because wounded pride can destroy a marriage. It can finish a friendship. Wounded pride is probably the greatest generator of lawsuits in our society. It destroys careers, but most of all, wounded pride separates us from God. We become, in a sense, like wounded animals that are in a cage or trapped in a cave. And we become unpredictable. We lash out often against the very people who can help us the most. And so there is probably no time that we are more spiritually vulnerable than in those moments or for some years of wounded pride. Self-pity comes a close second. Self-pity thinks all about me and little about anyone else. It's an all-consuming thing. The person who is sinking in self-pity is the person who says, you know, I just don't have what others have. Just look around. I never did anything to get what I deserve. Other people seem to be so much happier, so much better off. I always seem to be losing out in everything that I do. I don't have the possessions that I need to make me happy. I don't have any friends. This is a miserable place. No one loves me. And it becomes like a pit of quicksand. We dig ourselves deep into holes of discouragement and depression. We alienate other people when we wallow in self-pity, but most of all, we distance ourselves farther and farther back from God. And we succumb to the strategy of Satan. One of the ironies is that many times those of us who have the most in life, in terms of health and possessions, in terms of relationships and education, those of us that are on a comparative scale with the rest of the population of our globe are in the 99th percentile, are the ones who sometimes give in most readily to self-pity because we are unfamiliar with dealing with difficulty. And so when things finally, by comparatively small scale, go wrong, we deeply feel sorry for ourselves. Self-pity, in a sense, is pride that has just gone wild. Self-centeredness, I suppose, is pretty much the same. It is seeing everything in terms of me. It is as if in every room I am at the center, as if in every conversation and everything that is happening, it is most about how it relates to me and not how it relates to someone else. Self-centeredness is also a consuming thing and an effective vulnerability for Satan. Because self-centeredness is an offense to other people. It is saying that they are not in the center, that they are not important. But most of all, self-centeredness puts God on the perimeter of our lives and steals from him the place that is rightly his. We need to listen carefully to understand that when life's temptations come our way, through the circumstances that are part of everyone's biography, when we are tempted to self-importance and self-pity, it is then that we are most highly vulnerable to the attacks of Satan, and that if we do not resist, we will become controlled, if not consumed, by the strategies of evil. And so what we need to do is to resist and to plan it in advance, because if we properly resist the devil and his strategies, then God promises that he will flee from us. And the Bible on this is also clear that there are two primary resources, very practical resources that are ours, and that we need to take advantage of them. In some ways, they are so simple that I suppose half of us will be tempted at least to just dismiss them and say, well, they don't apply to my problem, so I'm not willing to try that. They are, number one, the resource of the Bible. That was what Jesus used when he encountered Satan face to face, when it was a one-on-one competition. He repeatedly replied with a quotation that came directly from the Bible because he believed he knew something that we need to know. And that is that there is a power in God's word that is an awesome spiritual supernatural power. It means that daily reading and remembering of the Bible is grabbing hold of the potent weapon. The potent weapon that we need to battle against whatever we're up against. Against self-pity or against pornography or addiction or loneliness or illness or greed or discouragement or any other tactic of the devil. And if we do not take advantage of the resource that God has given to us, it is almost as if the linemen in the NFL would go into a game without helmet or pads. It is a guaranteed injury not to take advantage of the protection that is available. And so the very practical advice is to read the Bible every day and to remember what it says and to use it in the struggles we face. The second great resource that the Bible tells about is prayer. And I'm going to ask you to either take your own Bible or take the one that is in front of you with the blue cover and look so that there's a visual connection at Hebrews 4, 15 and 16. It's on page 1866. Referring to Jesus and what he faced in his circumstances and his pressures and testing. Hebrews 4, 15 and 16 say that we do not have in Jesus a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. So that God explains that through prayer we can have the resources of God to resist the devil, that we need to specifically ask for God's mercy, God's grace, God's help, and he promises to give to us not an easy path, but the resources that are needed to deal with what we're up against. And that does not mean just private prayer. It is another principle of the Bible that when Christians, even just two or three, get together, that there is a multiplication of the effectiveness in a mysterious and supernatural way. It's really a sad thing that many times when we face our greatest struggles of life, and when we want God's resources, that we just get alone and we just talk to God about it. Not that that is inappropriate, but we miss out if we are not part of praying together with other members of our family, of being part of a small group, of taking advantage of a community prayer gathering or the prayer sessions within the church. It's strange, but actually it's almost bizarre that we struggle so deeply with the problems that we have in life and fail to take advantage of the corporate collective nature of prayer, that when we pray with other Christians, there is accessible to us a supernatural answer and power that is even greater than what individual prayer can provide. This afternoon, across America from coast to coast and border to border, NFL teams are going to enter into another Sunday of fierce football competition before crowds of 10,000 times 10,000 people. Before each game, the coach will stand in front of the team in the locker room and will make a somewhat predictable speech. It will say that the competition is great, even if the other team has a losing record. That sometimes it seems that those that are the most likely to defeat are the most formidable of enemies. And so the enemy should not be underestimated. It is strong opposition that our team will face. And then it is the responsibility of the coach to give encouragement and advice on how to resist the other team's offense and to turn them around so that they end up running in the opposite direction. And now, far more important than that, far more important, is the spiritual battle that each of us will enter this afternoon and this week. And there is a sense in which this is our locker room, that we have gathered together as a team of people who are called Christians. I'm not the coach, but I relay to you the message of the coach, who says that the competition is real, it is fierce, and we're all going to be out on the field, and we're all going to face it. And that what we face is greater competition and far more important than any NFL game, including the Super Bowl game. That the enemy that we face is a million times stronger and smarter than any NFL line. And the coach speaks. And he is Jesus Christ himself. He says that the enemy is Satan. And his offensive line is huge. And Jesus Christ, the Savior, the Lord, the coach, says to us, resist the devil, and he will flee from you.
Woodhill Church gives both financially and in volunteers to a wonderful ministry to the Twin Cities through Midwest Challenge. And this morning, our focus guest is the Executive Director of Midwest Challenge, Hank Rosso, who comes to give an update of one of Midwest Challenge's most recent ministries into the cities, the Modern Times Cafe. Thanks, Hank.
Thank you. It's great to be here this morning, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate the friendship that exists between Wooddale Church and Midwest Challenge. We are grateful for all of your help, your support, everything from the bunch of groceries that come into our residential treatment program brings tears to our staff members' eyes, and I mean that, to your volunteers. It's exciting to have a partnership with an organization, a ministry like yours. But you know, we've been on the same corner for 22 years doing the same thing. Our residential recovery program is bursting at the seams. Our juvenile jail work operates 7 days a week using 26 volunteer and paid staff members ministering to teenagers. And yet, in spite of all the excitement, everything that's going on there, last year we sat back and we decided we were kind of bored and we wanted to do something else closer in our neighborhood. And so we came across a concept, and we've called it the Modern Times Cafe. It's a ministry to the homeless. And what we do is we serve them breakfast with dignity 5 days a week, patterned after other restaurants that are operating around the country. There's nine others like us, Cafe 458 in Atlanta, Inspiration Cafe in Chicago. And we've found that bringing homeless people who fill three qualifications, they have to be sober, they have to have a desire to change, and they have to have a history of nonviolence. They meet those qualifications after being screened from the professionals in the homeless shelters that we work with. We bring them into our cafe. We surround them with a beautiful environment, fresh flowers on the tables that are donated by the Chicago Lake Florist every week, beautiful Lori Line music, and just a nice atmosphere used to boost their self-esteem, to help them feel like they're somebody special. I've been in soup kitchens. I volunteered, and they do an incredible work. And it's impossible for them to do what we're doing because they feed so many more people. But we're not a food program. We're an organization that is set out to help the homeless get out of homelessness, to boost them out of their situation. We found that providing breakfast with dignity, using volunteers, not only serving them breakfast off a menu, but sitting down with them and asking them how we can help them set goals and accomplish goals to change their life. Now, we're brand new at this. We're learning as we go, but that's how Columbus discovered America, right? Just by winging it. And yet we found some incredible success stories. This evening, at the 6 p.m. Choices service, I'll be sharing many testimonies. But you know, one that touches my heart is one that took place about 3 months ago. Care 11 news team, Gail Plawocki and her photographer were just finished taking pictures and doing a spiel on our cafe, and they just sat down and had breakfast with us, and a familiar man stepped into the front door. He looked familiar, but I couldn't place him. He sheepishly sat down to a table, and one of our guests gave him a menu, and then he came up to our table, and he said, "Excuse me, you may not remember me, but I was one of your first guests here 3 months ago." I came here. And as you served me breakfast and you treated me with respect and love, you encouraged me to deal with my alcoholism. I just kind of blew it off and I put up with your preaching at me for a few weeks. But finally I felt, you know, I am somebody. I am important. I can do something with my life. Well, for the last few months, I've been in an alcoholic treatment program. And I'm here today to tell you thank you. I'm in a halfway house. I've graduated from this other program. I have a car. I have a job. I wanted to come by and pay for my breakfast and say thank you. I mean, Gail Plawocki and the Care 11 team, they thought, wow, did you plan this? No, but God did. God did. Everybody's excited once they step into the door and they become a part of it. I encourage you, if you'd like to be a part of something exciting, some weekday morning before you go to work for just a half an hour to an hour, you'll find that that small investment of time could change somebody's life. Thank you again for your friendship and your support of this great new work.
Hi, Michelle. Is Paula there? Yeah, thanks. Hi, honey. How was your day? Good. So you guys are going to the football game tonight, huh? Yeah, I know you told me, but I was thinking about you, just wanted to give you a call. Well, Grandma's here. She's in the kitchen right now. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll have a really good time tonight. Listen, don't stay out too late. I'll see you tomorrow after school. Bye. Thanks.
What's this?
It's a bottle, Mom. It hasn't been opened in case you didn't notice.
Did you leave this in the cupboard and ask me to get you a glass of water by coincidence?
No, Mom. I called you for help, both literally and figuratively.
Well, here I am. What's happening?
Well, to start with, Benny called me last week.
Benny? Did you take the call?
Well, he kind of caught me off guard. He just wanted to get together for a little bit.
Laura, you agreed to that, didn't you? I thought Benny moved to Chicago after his parole. Did you pick up the Smirnoff for Benny?
No, no. Maybe I justified it that way last week, but listen, we're getting off the track, Mom. I don't want to talk to you about Benny. I want to talk to you about God. Mom, where is he?
Whatever do you mean?
Listen, you prayed for me all those years and it worked. I mean, last March I actually found God and it was so great to know who Jesus is, to accept what he did for me. I mean, there was finally hope, a light in my life, but you know, all of your prayers. I don't know where I'd be without AA, but
it's been wonderful for me, too, to see your strength and to watch you grow. And our conversations have helped me grow, too.
But that's just it, Mom. I'm not that strong. I feel every day like I'm going to cave in to partying with Benny or anybody like him.
Laura, you've only been a Christian for 8 months, and so much has changed for the good.
Yeah, but Mom, I'm scared. I'm really scared. Didn't God say he'd take away the temptations from my life? Didn't he promise to take away my sin? I mean, I just feel sometimes like I'm drowning. If it wasn't for Paula, I mean, we all know how much happier she is.
Laura, God isn't going to give you any more than you can handle.
Mom, somebody in my Bible study last week said that when they became a Christian, all their addictions disappeared. I mean, they have not had a craving since. What's wrong with me? I mean, did I really accept Jesus? Maybe I'm not a Christian yet.
No, no, dear. We can't ever expect someone else's experience to be exactly like ours. If God chose to give that person instant freedom, that's wonderful. But it doesn't always happen that way. Laura, we all have our weak areas, and you lived for 10 years in a lifestyle that hooked you physically and emotionally. Give yourself credit for the things that you've changed in these last weeks.
I'm trying. Mom, do you know how much time I used to spend just thinking about using? Where to meet Benny, what time, where to get the cash, what to do after. Oh, I don't need to go into it. I am trying to pray now instead. Oh, honey, I wish this were easier for you. But can you hear yourself? You're doing the right things. Mom, last week Paula, at the age of 13, told me she was tired of trying to figure it all out. I know what she means. Why can't it be easier?